Hello, this is the podcast for our last class on December the 6th, class number 28. And here we talked about the cause of action for intentional infliction of emotional distress. And we finished off discussing privileges. Remember, privileges are just essentially the same thing as defenses in negligence and the other torts that we've discussed, but for intentional torts, privileges are thought to take it out of the realm of a tort at all. Just saying I had a right to do this, so my action wasn't tortious, as opposed to defenses, I did it, but you did it too. So in negligence. So intentional infliction of emotional distress is an unusual cause of action because it is so vague. It's much vaguer, that much more vague than the other types of torts we've discussed. All it says is that the behavior is extreme or outrageous and leads to severe emotional distress. Notice that we're focusing on the behavior of the defendant, not so much the reaction of the plaintiff, as opposed to negligent infliction of emotional distress. This is that's solely plaintiff focused, and talks about where the plaintiff was located, what the plaintiff saw, whether the plaintiff was afraid for their own safety. Here, it's focused on the conduct of the defendant. And that's only right, really, because, again, intentional torts are really conduct-based. We want to stop antisocial behavior, antisocial, disruptive, dangerous behavior. So we focus more here on the behavior of the defendant rather than any reaction by the plaintiff. So the cases, we started with the notion, do we need, does intentional infliction of emotional distress need a physical injury? No. It's the emotional distress. Our first case says it's the only requirement is that the emotional distress be severe, McDermott v. Reynolds. The case before that. Womack v. Eldridge just needs, even though there's no physical harm, there's enough evidence there for the jury to determine that the behavior was extreme and outrageous. Again, this case illustrates it's not so much that there's a harm on the part of the plaintiff. We just want to stop this deceitful, lying kind of behavior that was for the purpose or substantially certain to involve the plaintiff in a child molestation case. So, again, we're just looking at the behavior of the defendant. Second thing we talked about, does emotional distress looks at the conduct of the defendant, behavior of the defendant, and shouldn't be used as a substitute for any other tort. So that in McDermott v. Reynolds, court says, really what our plaintiff was suing for was alienation of affection. This was barred by the statute. So regardless of the emotional distress that may have been caused, the conduct itself, that is the conduct of the defendants in flaunting the relationship, that's the court says, is not what we're concerned about. The conduct is not, it was already eliminated by statute that this conduct was in some way tortious. So you can't go around that and then all of a sudden start suing for emotional distress. The idea here was to remove the conduct of this nature from tort jurisdiction. Don't turn one tort into another. Finally, we looked at when torts themselves interfere with some other protected right, the tort of intentional infliction of emotional distress bumps against the rights, the constitutional rights. Constitutional rights are always going to win out. Our interest in freedom of speech, freedom of expression, are always more compelling than any interests that we have in protecting individuals' freedom from anguish. So the Hustler magazine, Hustler v. Falwell, illustrates this perfectly. There's no indication that Jerry Falwell wasn't upset about this parody that appeared. But certainly, court says, you know what, he's a public figure. And Times v. Sullivan already said public figures can't sue for libel, for defamation, for invasion of privacy. They have no privacy. And you can't sue for intentional infliction of emotional distress just as a substitute for those other actions. This was a close one. This case made history, but because notice the lower courts had said, both the trial court and the court of appeals, it said, okay, no libel, no invasion of privacy, but a intentional infliction of emotional distress is a good action. Here the court says, no, these parodies are entitled to the same protection that we would give to anything else, and it has to be a higher standard. So the court here then protects these ad parodies to the same extent as they would protect any other First Amendment rights. Then we moved on to talk about privileges. Privileges are essentially defenses, tort defenses, but again, they're saying that because the actions that the actions that are allegedly tortious were privileged for some reason, it prevents them from being tortious at all. Main privileges. So remember, privileges only come about from somebody who is being accused of assault or battery or false imprisonment, any of these torts that we've talked about. What's our first privilege? Consent. Remember, the defendant has the burden of proving the privilege, and consent there would be a privilege to assault or battery or false imprisonment, and all it does is say, you said it was okay to do this. Don't turn around and claim battery if you voluntarily consented to engage in a prize fight. And that's the subject of our case, Hart v. Gazelle. Here there was a prize fight which had been made illegal, prize fighting. The defendant is the victor. The plaintiff is truly the loser because the plaintiff dies. And the defendant is now in a wrongful death action, a battery action. The defendant is now exerting the privilege of consent, saying they agreed to fight. And our plaintiff says, I can't, the plaintiff's decedent said he couldn't have consented because it was illegal. The action of prize fighting is illegal. You can't consent to an illegal act. The court here adopts truly the minority viewpoint to say, to deny the plaintiff any relief, saying the plaintiff consented, so can't sue, so the plaintiff can't bring about in any action. So the defendant, who is the winner in the prize fight, actually wins the case. If the plaintiff, the dead fellow, had exerted a good consent defense, the plaintiff, who is the loser, would have won the lawsuit. My point was that by giving consent as a good privilege to beating somebody to a pulp, the court certainly isn't discouraging these prize fights, even though they're illegal. This business of consent to an illegal act being valid is very much, even though the court adopts it here, it's very much a minority rule these days, because the idea, the majority rule, is the idea we want to discourage prize fighting, we want to discourage illegal activity. So if you provide consent as a privilege, it doesn't discourage it at all. You're benefiting from your participation in the illegal activity. In terms of being a valid consent, you have to, it can be manifested by verbally, it can be expressed or implied. You have to have the capacity to consent. You can't, there's a scope of the consent. Sometimes it's a difficult question of fact. You consent to a touch football game, but you doesn't mean you consent to be bitten or gouged during that game. Self-defense, very practical kind of privilege. It's not practical to wait for a judicial remedy. If you're getting beaten up, self-defense is a good privilege. It's very much of a practical one. What the defendant is saying is that he or she may have battered or assaulted the plaintiff, but they were doing so in self-defense. The plaintiff is really the one at fault. So self-defense, not so much of a justification as a privilege. You can have defense of self, defense of property, or defense of another. But it can only extend to actual protection. Self-defense is protection, not aggressive. Defense has to be reasonable and appropriate, proportional to the harm. Not in retaliation. This Courvoisier v. Raymond case, defendant shot plaintiff under the mistaken belief that the plaintiff was part of a rowdy crowd. The jury instruction here was faulty because it didn't allow for this justification of self-defense. You're under no duty to retreat. If you're being threatened, you can stand your ground and defend yourself. You're under no duty to retreat. Defense of others. You can use reasonable force to defend others. Some say it's only if a person's being attacked. No privilege if a person was resisting arrest. Restatement. It says you can use it any time. Defense of others. Defense of property. Can't use deadly force in defense of property. You can use deadly force if it's necessary, if it's proportional, in defense of yourself, but it's never justified to protect your property. Katko v. Brinney. Unoccupied house. Spring gun, shot. the plaintiff is shot while trespassing, intending to rob the defendant. Defendant says he didn't want to injure anybody. Human life, the court says the spring gun is an injury, certainly. And the ultimate is human life is placed over property rights, even though our defendant was definitely there to rob. No defense of property should place another in peril of their life. Even if the intruder intends to commit larceny, deadly force should not be used. So mechanical devices such as spring guns are never reasonable. Defense of your habitation, given higher status. Strangely enough, if you look at the restatement allows deadly force if you're protecting your house. Better view is that the deadly or serious force is not permitted unless the intruder threatens the occupant's safety. And then private necessity, which is basically a justification saying that it minimizes overall loss, intentional use or destruction of another's property in order to save your own property. Not based on any of the plaintiff's conduct that self-defense was or consent. This is an incomplete privilege. It's a privilege to use another's property to save your own, but if doing so you damage the property, you have to pay for it. So you're not going to have to pay if there's no damage, but if there's damage, court says it's only fair to pay. And that's the Vincent v. Lake Erie case. Very famous case. A ship was making use of another's property at the dock, kept lashing, reattaching the ship to the dock during a heavy storm. The ship was saved, but the dock was seriously damaged. There was a trespass to the dock, but the court said, no liability, no tort, but you have to pay the damages. It was justified. So no punitive damages, no other types of damages except compensatories. And the compensatories just pay for the damage to the dock. And then, again, public necessity. Public necessity. Necessity to protect a privilege to take other people's property in order to take your property in order to protect the property of others. And that's a complete privilege. Distinguish this from Vincent, where one is acting for his own benefit. Sirocco v. Geary, a house is blown up in order to prevent the spread of fire. The court adopted the view that an officer is entitled to act for the public benefit without liability. Vincent, one is acting for his own benefit, liable for damages. Geary, you're acting for the public benefit, not liable. And this relates to takings, the whole notion of takings that you get into in property and con law. Governmental usurpation of the property of others for the good of all. Okay, so our review session is on the, whenever it says, I think it's the 17th. I'm very open after the 13th, from about the 13th to the 20th, when our exam is, I'll be very open to office hours and I'll post some suggested times. So if you need any time specifically, let me know after your exams are over that weekend. I'll have some weekend office hours and then we can see how much is necessary after that.